Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. For millennia, cats have been celebrated as secretive, mysterious companions, content to live alongside, yet apart from humans. But science is beginning to reveal that their cool exterior actually conceals hidden depths of emotion and affection for us and for each other. This morning, we discuss what our cats are actually thinking, feeling, and understanding, and what they are trying to communicate to us. My guest is Tom McNamee, author of The Inner Life of Cats, The Science and Secrets of Our Mysterious Feline Companions. Tom's book interweaves the latest research about animal behavior with the engaging tale of his evolving relationship with his beloved Augusta to illuminate what drives cats to do the enigmatic, often maddening things that they do, and what compels humans to love them. Tom, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I've often thought of, while dogs are a reflection of our life out in the world, they accompany us, we go to the dog park with them, and they're part of our public life. Cats, on the other hand, are a reflection of our inner souls. And I think very few people know our cats, aside from those who come to our house frequently. And this was really brought home to me when I sent out the email announcement for this show. And I put photographs of both my cats on the email. And a couple people who know the cats well really responded, "Oh, that's Frida and Fellini." And other people who don't know the cats thought, you know, they're just cats. On the other hand, my dog is right now outside in the radio station here, hanging out with the receptionist, greeting people as they come in the door. So I wonder how you see that as like the difference, like this kind of stark difference between our relationships with cats and dogs.
Well, dogs have been with us for a long, long time. Some people say as long as possibly 100,000 years back when people were hunting and gathering. And cats entered the human picture possibly as long ago as 10,000 years. There were some discoveries not too long ago in Cyprus where there seemed to have been some ceremonial burials of people and cats together, but there's no indication that they were actually pets then. The first sign that cats were being treated with as any sort of domestic animal was only about 5,000 years ago when they show up in Egyptian temple paintings with a collar and a leash. Even then, we don't know if they were being just held as sort of ceremonial animals, ceremonial mysterious companions. And then, of course, they were our companions for a long time as hanging around the granary to kill rodents. Then undoubtedly, they were appreciated, and they certainly lost their fear of humans. But whether their capacity for affection developed that long ago, we don't know. The actual indications of true domesticity with cats, you know, purring in your lap, that may go back only a few hundred years. And so undoubtedly they've had that capacity for a long time. The question is whether the social situation existed that allowed them to express it. And so dogs have long had this capacity, particularly since they've descended from social animals in the first place, from wolves, which have you know, through literally millions of years, had the capacity to communicate with one another, and then later as dogs to communicate with us very easily. Cats were never social animals, particularly in the wild. And so they have become social animals in recent times, but they're not so easy to read. You have to learn. You have to pay attention. And then once you do, it can be profoundly rewarding, both to us and to them. And a deep and complex bond certainly can develop, as any attentive cat owner can tell you. But it's most people, I mean, many people just look at a cat and say, well, you can't tell anything about it.
Well, I have heard a theory once that actually humans made the first overtures toward domesticating dogs, but that in fact cats were the ones who more or less domesticated humans.
I don't know. there's also the argument that cats aren't even really domesticated at all.
Right.
They've just adapted to human presence. I personally think they are domesticated, but they also have a lot of wild characteristics.
What I was thinking is that this theory that they came around the granaries, which, according to what you say, may not have been the first interaction between cats and people, but cats saw kind of an opportunistic opportunity. Here's these people, and they have all this great bait for mice, and so this is a really great place for me to hang out, and that was what kind of helped them to overcome their fear of people. Do you think there's much validity to that theory?
Absolutely, absolutely. And then I think over time, certain cats became less and less afraid, and children probably began to play with kittens. And so those cats, which had the really friendly natures, developed a reproductive advantage. And so literally, Darwinian evolution brought us cats that were friendly and adaptable, truly, as pets.
Now, there's these cats that are, at least mythologically, have a closer lineage to the original wild cats and other domesticated cats. And I noticed, one of the first things I noticed in your book was the picture of your cat, Isabella, who looked very much like my cat, Fellini, but it turns out since the picture wasn't in color, your cat is a Bengal mix and my cat is a Egyptian Mau mix. But I never heard of Egyptian Mau until we got Fellini a number of years ago. And I started researching him, and it supposedly was that the Egyptian Mau were like the closest descendants to the original wild cats in Africa, and that I understand Bengal, well, and it sounds like Bengal cats are more of a hybrid of a recent time. But do you know much about Egyptian Maus, and if it's true that they are closer to their wild compatriots than other domestic cats?
I don't know about that breed, no. But I can tell you, however, that all our domestic cats are very, very closely related to the North African wild cat. And, in fact, it's a subspecies. There's a species called Felis silvestris, which has various wild subspecies all around the world. And, for example, there's a European wildcat, and if you try to tame the kittens of that subspecies, forget it. They'll never be tame. They'll always try to attack you. They'll tear up your furniture. They're completely impossible. But to this day, if you take a North African wildcat, Felis silvestris libica, and you swipe kittens out of a litter, you can take them home, and they'll be nice little kitties. And so the relationship between Felis silvestris libica and Felis silvestris catus, which is our domestic cat, is still extremely close. They're almost the same thing, except that our particular subspecies, as I mentioned, has developed this ability to be loving and true companion. That particular one breed you're talking about may be closer, I don't know, morphologically in some way, but all our cats, whether it's a Persian or a Siamese or what have you, they're all essentially identical genetically to the original North African wild cat.
Now, I'm kind of curious about your cat that's a Bengal mix and how that mix came to be, because I learned about that at the same time that I was researching the Egyptian Mau. And one characteristic that both the Egyptian Mau and the Bengal have is they have much longer hind legs, kind of like cheetahs, and they're really fast runners.
Right, yeah. I think the Bengal was almost an accident. They were looking for some sort of medical. It had some medical property. I can't remember what it was. In any case, the amount of Bengal in Isabel is very, very small, and her behavior is a little bit different. She has, her voice is a little different. She kind of goes eh, eh, instead of meowing. And as you say, she's taller in back, and she's got a few facial characteristics that are Bengal in nature, but she's really more of a tabby cat than anything else. And yeah, and her behavior is just like that of any old tabby cat.
Yeah, well, I found with our cat Fellini that he's really, well, I was told by a groomer who first cut his nails when he was a kitten that Egyptian Maus are very mouthy and very vocal. And those both turned out to be very true.
Is that right?
And it's interesting.
I
want to get into this subject of cats talking. He sounds like he's talking Hebrew. And then there's a whole lot of glottal stops. And every so often he'll say something that sounds like, hello. and he'll walk around the middle of the night, like, and sometimes he'll kind of yowl a little bit, which reminds me of an old cat I had when she was starting to suffer from kidney failure. I mean, because it sounds like that kind of dementia cat that you described. But he's been doing it since he was 10 weeks old when we got him. And it seems like it's part of his vocalizations. And he's really, he's very demanding in the way that he vocalizes. And then his sister, who is a long hair tortoiseshell with a little bit of white. They both have the same white chest and paws. And she has a totally different voice. And it's really interesting to think, see these two littermates and wondering where their voices come from. So, for one
thing, they're littermates, you say?
They're littermates. Obviously, they had different fathers.
Yeah, and yeah,
I think their mother was gray with white paws and a white chest, because that's the only part that they have it similar. But I'm curious about, like, for one thing, the different voices of cats. Before we get into how we communicate with them, it seems like every cat has as much of a distinctive voice as human beings do, or maybe rhesus monkeys.
That's true, and I presume you talk back to this cat, right?
All the time.
Yeah, because there's a considerable stretch in my book that concerns a study that was done in 1944 by a woman named Mildred Mulk, who studied three of her own cats for years, their vocalizations in particular, and she transcribes them in that international phonetic language, which we all know and find so mysterious, most of us, I think. And she paid such close attention that she was able to discern the difference between, let's say, a slightly angry hesitation and a fearful hesitation. That is a vocalization for each of those. And over time, she was able to distinguish a lot of different vocalizations and their meanings. But she was able to confirm those by comparing them with the work done by various other people all around the world at the time. However, she also discovered that these languages often develop between the owner and the individual owner and the individual cat. So you can develop a dialect, if you will, between yourself and your cat. It won't be the same one as the one that develops between your next-door neighbor and their cat.
Actually, with both of our cats, we have very different dialects, I guess. Because one of them, I mean, the Egyptian Malmix has this kind of, he speaks in Hebrew and we talk back to him and whatever.
So you talk to him in Hebrew? Do you speak Hebrew?
No, I don't speak Hebrew very well, no. No, I actually don't speak in Hebrew. I kind of imitate his vocalization. His
right.
Sister does a lot of like meh, meh kind of sounds, and then they get and then she does these things I could not even possibly reproduce. But I spend a lot of time talking to her, and I feel like she knows exactly what I'm saying, and I have no idea what either one of us are saying, except that there's a bond of love between us.
Right, of course. Right. Yeah, my Isabel has this a number of Bengal sounds, and I think she calls me by name. Actually, I mean, this is probably stupid, but. When she greets me in the morning, she always just goes, eh-eh. And I figure that's her name for me. That's Tom. Eh-eh.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Tom McNamee, who is the author of The Inner Life of Cats, The Science and Secrets of Our Mysterious Feline Companions. What's very interesting to me is the ways that we communicate with cats and how that is shaped in part also by their socialization. So let's talk a little bit about how cats are socialized and why some cats are affectionate and some cats are not.
I think probably the single most important thing in The Inner Life of Cats, my book, comes from a study that was in the technical literature in 1988, but never escaped from the technical literature because it was just before the internet became the primary means of distribution of knowledge. And the woman who did the study, Eileen Karsh, retired from scientific work just right after she published that paper. It was part of a symposium in Switzerland back in the mid-80s, and she made these discoveries that really need to be known by people who raise cats all over the world, because it's very different from what has been the standard model. Most people to this day believe that kittens don't really need to learn anything from people until they're about 7 weeks old. What Karsh discovered was that kittens that are handled as early as 2 weeks begin to benefit from that handling in a very, very positive way, and that there are these narrow windows, developmental windows, when their brains are at certain stages of development, when certain kinds of experience go deeply into the formation of the adult cat. What she means when she says handling is cuddling, holding the cat in your hands, walking it around, and so forth, putting it up next to your face. And then through these early stages between, say, 2 and 7 weeks, gradually exposing the cat to other things like street sounds, car horn, vacuum cleaner, other people, little kids, the things that are often disturbing to a cat when they, a kitten, when they first experience them later. But if they hit them that early, then they're perfectly fine with it, and they gain, and they usually do these things if you can in the presence of the mother cat, so that the kitten never loses contact with the mother, and so they gain a confidence and a sense of trust very, very early, and the result is that you get a very well-adjusted, happy, confident, bold adult cat. And it's not to say that if the cat doesn't have those things happen to it, it's not going to be a good cat later on. It's just that the odds become less and less good as the kitten grows older if it's not getting that kind of treatment. So, and there have been some horrible experiments that she didn't do, but she knew about earlier, where kittens were raised in isolation. I mean, complete isolation, just like in a box with no mother, up to the age of, say, 14 weeks. And if you raise a kitten like that, where it's only fed and doesn't see anybody at all until it's 14 weeks old, well, of course, the cat is completely nuts and irreparably nuts. It never becomes possible to be handled or a pet or anything, really. It's just ruined.
Why do they do a study like that?
Yeah, I know. It's horrible.
I wonder what they were trying to figure out, except for the obvious.
Yeah, I know. In any case, that, you know, sort of to prove the negative. Karsh showed that if we start to nurture kittens at that very, very early age, we get a really solid grown-up cat. And if people who raise kittens now will start to realize that and start to do that, we're going to have a lot fewer problems with grown-up cats. I mean, there are, the fact of the matter is that a lot of cats have problems. You know, they don't pee in the box. They run away. They're scared to death of noises of thunderstorms or car backfiring. Augusta, the cat who is the hero of my book, we don't know what kind of kittenhood she had because she was dumped in our driveway in the snow in Montana when she was, 12 weeks old, something like that. And obviously the kind of person who dumps a kitten in the snow in December in Montana is probably not the ideal mother or father for a young kitten. So she was scared to death of all kinds of things. And if a guy walked into our house wearing big, heavy, clompy boots, I mean, Augusta was straight under the bed. She never learned to sit in my lap. She was afraid to sit in my lap. And, of course, there are plenty of cats all over the place who are possessed by fear. Or then, of course, there's the classic other kind of cat that never gets any stimulation or love or anything else and develops into what I call a living, breathing sofa cushion. You know, just cat that just sits there and has no life.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about the little bit of the biology of what makes cats so special. And there's their hearing, their seeing, and their smelling. And that's a place I learned an awful lot in your book, especially about smelling and why, for one thing, cats will sometimes sit with their mouth agape with this kind of really strange, kind of demented expression. So what is that about?
Yes. Well, cats have a phenomenal sense of smell. They have 3 times more olfactory receptors than dogs do. And that their life is a phenomenally olfactory one. I mean, you don't see them sniffing the ground like you see dogs do, but that's because they don't need to. Their world is a world of smell in many ways, and particularly in their social lives. And when you see your cat rubbing its chin against a chair leg, it's leaving a little olfactory marker that you'll never smell because you can't, but another cat can, and the other cat can determine sex, age, who it is, what kind of mood it's in, and so on. And when you see the cat with its mouth agape, it's known by the German term flammen, they're actually opening their mouth to open these two tubes that are just behind their front teeth, upper front teeth, that go straight to a center of the brain that has a whole separate set of neurons that interpret specifically pheromones left by other animals. And so that when they see, you see that mouth agape, they're reading signals from other animals, usually other cats. But they can also see where prey animals have been. You know, if a mouse has walked down a little path in the grass, sometimes you'll see the cat with his head down, with his mouth open, absorbing those smells. And in fact, when the cat genome was completed only in 2014, they discovered that along the strip of the chromosome where dogs have their auditory, some of their auditory related genes, cats have more olfactory genes.
It's kind of interesting because I noticed many years ago when I first had cats, like you'd put like some food on a dish on the floor and they might sniff around for a while before they found it. And so I was under the impression that cats had terrible sense of smell. So I was actually surprised to find out that their sense of smell is probably every bit as acute as, well, is it as acute as dogs or just like more focused?
It is as acute as dogs, yes. It's more so.
And then the other thing that I always know that cats could hear pretty well, and our cat Fellini has these very large ears, and they twitch, and they do all the things you describe in your book, the semaphore things. And so it's very obvious he's very attuned to every sound. But again, we have the stereotype of dogs having this fantastic hearing, and we don't really know that much about cats' hearing or think about it. So how does cats' hearing compare to dogs' hearing?
Well, it's better. They can hear higher, way higher sounds. So, for example, a cat that's hunting in a field, and like Augusta used to hunt in this little, we had this little grassy patch behind our house in Montana, and it was full of mice and voles and things like that, and they had little tunnels. This was an ungrazed former pasture, and so it had this matted grass where the grass would die over the winter, and so the critters made these little tunnels through there. And you could see Augusta just listening. And they can hear the prey animals actually underground, and so they can sit listening at the opening of a, say, a mouse's a little tunnel, and hear the critter way down, and wait for it to emerge because they know it's coming. And I don't think any dog can do anything like that. I mean, of course, dogs can hear extremely well, better than we can, but cats have much more highly tuned hearing in the way high ranges of frequencies, far beyond what we can hear. And of course, dogs, famous dog whistles, of course, where you know you blow this whistle and the dog can hear it and you can't hear anything. The same is true for cats. But of course, cats don't respond to whistles. They don't come when you whistle at them.
They don't always come when you call either, for that matter.
Depends. Right. Actually, you can train a cat to do almost anything, including come when you call, every time you call. In fact, I say in the book that one of the most important things you can ever teach your cat is the word no, because that's how you save their life. Because, you know, cats do these spooky things. They'll be spooked very readily and jump out of your car in the middle, in a gas station or by the side of the highway and immediately, you know, splat. Or you know, they'll jump out a window. This is a 40-story building. And if you teach them to say no, you can stop. You can save their life. And the way you teach cats to do almost anything is with so-called clicker training, where you've got a little little metal clicker, and in your other hand you've got a little treat, a little supermarket kitty treat, and when the cat does something that resembles the behavior you're trying to train, you go click, because it has to be immediate, so that they associate that click precisely with that behavior, and then you can walk over and give them the treat. The reason for the clicker is so that they associate the click with the behavior immediately, whereas it may take you 2 seconds to get over there with the treat, and by then they've forgotten what they're being rewarded for. And this way, you know, if you want to teach your cat to roll over, you start by clicking when the cat just lies on its side, let's say. And then you wait for the next time the cat kind of starts to roll, and you click again, and so forth. And same thing with getting a cat to stop. When the cat just stops on its own, you click and treat. And then when you go, hey, stop, you know, and if, you know, you might have to do it 20 times before the cat actually stops. And then when it does, click, treat. And eventually you get the association established that when you say stop, that means stop, and you don't have to treat them anymore. But they know that when you say stop, they have to stop. And you can save their lives.
So do you think that
and if you want to teach them to jump through hoops and do stuff like that, then you can teach them to do that too.
I don't think I want to do that. But can you?
No, I don't either. it takes a lot of patience to do this stuff.
Can you do a training with a cat who's 8 years old?
Sure. Yeah, you bet. Okay. I mean, I think it's easier. It's easier with a younger one, but Sure, you can do it.
It's interesting with our two cats. The male Fellini really has his own mind and does not listen. And he does know no, and he'll stop for a little bit. We actually started putting him into what we call a lockup in the front hall. There's a little airlock between the front door and the hallway. And when he would misbehave in the evening, we would just stick him there for a while, and it would calm him down. I think it was more of a cooling out than actually changing behavior. And his sister, on the other hand, is much more agreeable. And when you say no to her, she does whatever you respond to. I'll try the clicker trick with Fellini.
Yeah, try that, because, I mean, first of all, I should make the point, not that I don't think you're doing any harm by putting the cat in the room, but some people do have the idea that you can punish a cat for bad behavior. It does not work, ever. All it does is teach the cat to be afraid of you.
Yeah.
And the only way you can shape a cat's behavior is with rewards, and punishment never, ever works.
Yeah, I think I've noticed that. Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Tom McNamee, who's the author of The Inner Life of Cats, and we're talking about how it is, actually, that we've developed such strong bonds with these really amazing creatures. And what is it, do you think, that draws us to cats? What makes them besides being enigmatic, just also so attractive to human beings?
Well, there I have to speculate. I don't think there's anything proved about that. And I try to, most of my book relies on firm, double-blind scientific study. And so when you ask me a question like that, I have to just guess. But my guess is that they bring nature into your house. You have a wild animal in your house. And they've made some compromises in order to spend some time with you and to love you, which they do if you know how to love them. But they also are genuinely wild in the way that no other animal that can live in your house ever is, or no other domestic animal is. I mean, a horse can be somewhat wild, but not really. They're very dependent. And of course, cats are dependent too, I suppose, but I think the main thing is that there's a sense of wild nature there, that there's a limit to our ability to penetrate their nature. There's certain limits to our ability to understand them.
Well, actually, I think one of the lessons that I've understood about what cats teach us, I was walking past my next door neighbor's door the other day, and I saw my neighbor and her 4-year-old daughter, and they were both looking out the window at something. I was like, what are they looking at? And I looked up, and there was a bird on the wire. And then I realized that their cat was next to them, and they were following the lead of the cat and just watching this bird.
Yeah.
And I was imagining them all like inside this cat mind for this moment while they were doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the other thing, speaking of wildness, there's the other side of cats, which is feral cats, which are domestic cats that go wild for a variety of reasons. And you have a whole chapter in your book about feral cats. I want to first of all talk about the kind of romantic notion of feral cats in Rome. And there's also a new movie out about feral cats, I think, in Istanbul. And then get into some of the other more challenging issues about feral cats.
Sure. It's complicated. The whole thing is complicated. First of all, the ones in Rome are very different from the ones almost anywhere else. I think the ones in Istanbul are similar to the ones in Rome in that they're very much cared for. The ones that I particularly looked at for a long period of time are the ones that live in the Largo del Torre, Argentina. It's a ruin in the heart of Rome, which is sunk about 20 feet below street level, and so with sheer walls, and so they're there. They can get out, and occasionally they do, but usually they stay there because it's a great place to be, because they're beautifully fed, they're cared for, they get medical care, just a great place to live. And they've been there ever since, we know at least for 2,000 years. This is part of the ruin is the Theater of Pompey, where Caesar was killed in the year, whatever it was, 32 or something. Cats have been there ever since, and they live a great life. And all over Rome, there are ruins where there are cat colonies and people to take care of them. Rome is rich in volunteers, because it's still the case in Italy that, excuse me a second, there are a lot of women who don't work outside the home, and so and they're relatively prosperous and have the time and the means to volunteer in places like that. It wouldn't be feasible, I think, in the United States, because most women do work outside the home. And the United States probably wouldn't fund this kind of thing. And so as a result, for example, here we have immense and still catastrophically growing colonies of feral cats in cities. And there are these attempts to reduce the populations usually by a technique called trap, neuter, and return, where they are trapped and taken to the local ASPCA or wherever, and they're neutered, and they're given whatever veterinary care they might need, and then they're taken back to where they came from, and no longer reproducing, with the idea that the populations will eventually shrink. The problem is that people continue to dump fertile cats into the population, often in the form of kittens. And so TNR, as it's called, it's a great idea, except it doesn't work. It works in a few places. It works in a place where there's a boundary around it, as in the Largo Argentina. But it doesn't even work in the Largo Argentina, actually. The Eugenia Natoli, the biologist whom I was working with there, tells me, has written, in fact, technical papers about why TNR isn't even working in the Largo Argentina, because people sneak in at night and they dump kittens in there. And until people get it through their heads that you can't just have kittens for fun, because you want to have some kittens for your kids and then you can't get rid of them, then this is going to continue to be a problem. And there's also the difficulty. People talk about the harm that feral cats do, and in some places they do some terrible harm. In some other places, the harm that feral cats do is actually exaggerated. But we forget, many of the so-called advocates of feral cats forget how miserable their lives are. So you fix them and then you put them back where they were. Well, back where they were is a terrible place to be. They live in conditions of starvation or semi-starvation. They are killed by dogs. They run out into traffic and they're squashed or, injured. They're attacked by big male cats. Dogs attack them. They often catch horrible diseases. It's a terrible life in many cases. So it's a tough question. It's a tough problem, and there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of them in every major city in the United States.
Well, one of the things that I was interested to learn in your book is that, according to, I guess, most statistics, feral cats are largely responsible for songbird kills in the United States. And
yes,
Perhaps around the world. And I've had a lot of trips laid on me by people about how my cats, because my cats, when they were outdoor cats, definitely killed a few birds. Not that many, but they still contributed. And I have had friends who were adamant, ardent cat lovers, who once their cats died, well, one of them actually does bird rescue, and she doesn't even like cats anymore. And the other one decided not to have cats, and she still loves cats, but she doesn't want to have another cat because she doesn't want to have an outdoor cat, and she couldn't keep a cat indoors.
Well, birds die. Other things kill birds. That's why birds have high reproductive rates. You kill all the baby robins that have just been born, robin parents have another nest full of eggs. And most of the bird killing that cats do, it may be aesthetically offensive to people who love birds or people who love cats for that matter, but most of the, millions of birds being killed by cats all over the United States, most of those bird populations are resilient enough to sustain that mortality. It's nature. Other things kill birds. Peregrine falcons kill birds, for heaven's sake. And for the most part, American songbird populations, while they are falling, the decline in those songbird populations is due to habitat destruction. Often it's in destruction of their habitats in the tropics of their winter habitat. Not predation by cats. Now, there are places, and they're critical, where cats have driven birds species to extinction. There are other places where the birds and other animals are on the brink of extinction due to cat predation. But those are isolated. They're often islands or island-like habitats, and in those places, cats absolutely have to be removed. You need to kill every last cat. There's no question about it. And there are places, for example, as in Australia and New Zealand, where the native fauna have evolved without anything resembling a four-legged predator and a mammalian predator, and you just got to get rid of the cats. I'm not crazy about this, but the fact is that sort of the backyard cat, killing of birds by cats, it's not that big a deal in most places.
So I wonder, because I've heard from a lot of bird advocates that they really feel like, I've seen these statistics about the number of birds killed and the percentage of birds killed that are killed by cats. And there isn't a distinction usually made between feral cats and domestic or homed cats. So do you feel like this is something overblown and is overlooking the actual problem of bird kills by cats?
Well, again, you need to look at it population by population. I do think that, as far as I can tell, that most major, very large populations of songbirds, even with including kills by feral cats, are not being reduced. As far as I can tell, there's a book out now called Cat Wars that makes it sound as if, birds are being wiped off the face of the earth by cat predation. It's ridiculous. It's not true. But if feral cat populations continue to grow, and they are growing, it's going to be a problem. And, feral cats are a problem, period. Feral cats, being a feral cat, is a problem. And, of course, the harm that they do can be devastating in places. So, we do need to do something about feral cats.
And one last thing is, I wonder about what's your thoughts about whether cats should be indoor, outdoor, indoor and outdoor. In my neighborhood, it's becoming iffier and iffier to have outdoor cats because we have so many coyotes in the neighborhood and we live right near a wildlife refuge.
So that kind of limits it.
It's also limited the bird kills. The other day we were watching these hummingbirds. We've had tens of hummingbirds in our yard all the time now. And every time I'm watching them, I'm really happy that the cats are indoors now.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also happy the cats are indoors, so I don't worry about them when sometimes they wouldn't come in at night, and it's midnight, and I find Fellini up on the back fence refusing to come down, and I know coyotes in the neighborhood. It makes me very nervous.
Yeah. Well, it's a judgment call, I guess. If you live next to a busy road, I certainly wouldn't let my cat out because they're not very good about roads. If you got coyotes around, that's a risk, too. Isabel goes with me to Montana for 3 months every summer, and I let her out, and I know it's dangerous. Augusta grew up in Montana. We were out in wild, really wild country. We were right on the edge of the Absaroka Beartooth Wilderness, so we had bears, we had eagles, we had owls, we had coyotes, we had a lot of predators around, and the main thing we did was to be as sure as possible that she was not out at dawn or dusk or certainly at night, because those were the danger periods. But I felt that, for her to have a full life as a cat, to be a cat, we'll take the risk. And, nothing ever happened to her. Now, here in San Francisco, Isabel goes with me to Montana in the summer, and I let her out, and I sometimes walk around with her. And she's never had a problem in Montana. However, she was attacked by a raccoon here in San Francisco, in a very densely populated part of town. Raccoons bit her and at the base of her tail, and it was a pretty severe injury. We have hummingbirds in the backyard. She's never caught one yet. She looks at them. She'd like to kill one. Maybe she's too bad fat. I don't know. She can't jump as high as a hummingbird flies. you know, it's a judgment call.
Yeah, actually, our cats have both caught one hummingbird each, and that was mm-hmm. the hardest one of all. Well, we're just about out of time. Is there any last wisdom you'd like to share with us about cats before we say goodbye?
Well, I guess I'd like to say to people who don't get cats at all, you know, I don't want to say they're dog people who don't get cats, but that's sometimes true. But there are also people who have cats who don't quite get this. And cats are richly complex creatures with complex emotional systems and complex intellects, if you will. They can learn a lot. They know a lot. You can learn from them a lot. And most importantly, people need to understand that they have a deep capacity for love, to love and to be loved. And if they are not being considered with those capabilities, then they should be.
Well, it's really good talking with you, Tom, and I hope my cats have been listening to the show. So thanks for writing your book.
Thank you, and I hope Fellini's having a great time.
I'm sure he is. we've been talking this morning with Tom McNamee, who's author of The Inner Life of Cats, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll prepare for the March for Science, which is happening on Earth Day, by talking with Jackie Wirtz, co-chair for the March for Science PDX Communications Team. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Laura Nero. Thanks for listening.